Welcome to the B'nai B'rith International Podcast. I'm CEO Dan Mariashen. Thank you for tuning in today. A little bit of housekeeping before we get started. Be sure to visit our website, B'naiBrith.org, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. The easiest way to get the latest episode is to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play on your smartphone. I'm joined today by David Michaels, our Director of United Nations and Intercommunal Affairs here at B'nai B'rith International. David and I recently returned from Geneva, Switzerland, where we advocated for Israel to the United Nations Human Rights Council, along with other representatives from our B'nai B'rith delegation. In his speech on the floor of the Human Rights Council, David emphasized the hypocrisy of the UNHRC's disproportionate emphasis on Israel. Before that, we were in Paris, and we organized meetings with officials at UNESCO, another organization whose bias against Israel is very problematic in our view. Today, David and I will be discussing the delegation's experiences at both UNESCO and the Human Rights Council and the biggest issues and challenges we face with both organizations. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be with you.
Well, we've just wrapped up our leadership mission. Let's talk to our listeners a bit more about our delegation and those with whom we met, and perhaps more importantly, why it is important to go to these UN agencies in person to advocate for Israel.
Sure. Well, as our listeners know, one of the centerpieces of B'nai B'rith's advocacy for Israel around the world has been our engagement since the very start, 7 decades ago, at the United Nations, and particularly at a key body like the Human Rights Council, as well as UNESCO. We go with an international leadership delegation every March. March is the main of the 3 annual sessions of the Human Rights Council. And over the last couple of years, we've made a point of stopping in Paris as well to signal our concern over negative trends at UNESCO, which is headquartered in Paris. So in this case, in the case of this particular visit, we brought between 20 and 30 leaders of B'nai B'rith and friends of B'nai B'rith from over half a dozen countries, mainly in North America and Europe, to meet with as many ambassadors and other senior diplomats that we possibly could during a very busy time, both in Geneva and in Paris. In only 2 days in Paris, our delegation managed to meet with roughly 24 ambassadors and other diplomats. And in Geneva, in another 3 days, we met with another 36 or so ambassadors there, in addition to a private meeting with the new Director General of UNESCO. Finally, B'nai B'rith has had a custom over the years of holding a diplomatic reception at the Palais des Nations, the European headquarters of the UN in Geneva, where we were addressed by the chef de cabinet of the director general of the UN in Geneva, by the Israeli ambassador, and that event had the attendance of several dozen additional ambassadors and other diplomats.
Well, before we proceed, it's important perhaps at this point to just set the table a little bit in terms of B'nai B'rith's connection to the UN. We were just one of a few organizations, Jewish organizations, that were invited to the founding of the UN in San Francisco in 1945. And then a couple of years later, 1947, we received our first non-governmental organization NGO credentials at the UN. And then not too long after that, in 1960, we established the first full-time office on UN affairs in the Jewish community. So we really go way back to the beginning of the United Nations. It was a different world in 1945. The objectives and the mission of the UN was in the ashes of World War II and the Holocaust to create a better world for its billions of inhabitants, and it seems to have really come off the track. We today are represented at UNESCO not only with this delegation, but also during the course of the year by a representative, and at UNESCO and also at the Human Rights Council, where B'nai B'rith has a local committee that tracks and monitors the activities of the Human Rights Council. So we're deeply involved in the system, but over the past number of years, it seems that most of our work has really been devoted to the anti-Israel bias inside of the organization. Well, David, as you said, our first stop was at UNESCO in Paris, which has a new director general. UNESCO has been characterized over many, many years by bias against Israel, and it's always been subject to scrutiny, not only because of that bias, but even before that, with other issues that came up, at least that I can recall over the past 30 years. But now the bias really is centered on Israel. And it seems to me that, you know, there's a numbers issue here that enters into this bias as well, where you have the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is an umbrella of more than 50 Islamic countries, the Non-Aligned, which is an organization, an umbrella of more than 100 countries, and bringing, for example, the Palestinians into UNESCO as a member, or attempting to follow the Palestinian narrative on rewriting the Jewish history in Eretz Yisrael. How do you assess the lineup that Israel faces at UNESCO? And we have a new director general. We had an opportunity to speak with her. How would you think that this will unfold now going forward?
Well, there's no question that UNESCO, the case of UNESCO, has been particularly disappointing to us. UNESCO is one of those bodies within the UN orbit that should be the most removed, in relative terms, of course, from politics, let alone contentious politics. We all care about culture. We all care about education. We all care about science, and these should not be enmeshed or bogged down in any kind of political squabbles that you might find in the world, and not only political squabbles in the Middle East. And that said, as you've indicated, the math and the politics as a result of that math facing Israel within the membership of bodies like UNESCO is incredibly challenging. As I've mentioned, there's a near automatic majority that essentially marches in lockstep on siding with the Palestinians, but more than siding with the Palestinians, pushing Israel down even as they try to advance in entirely inappropriate and counterproductive ways Palestinian political goals. So as in 2011, as you've acknowledged, the Palestinians were admitted as a full member state, even in advance of having that status in reality to the body. And ever since, we've seen this escalation and intensification of a campaign to introduce resolutions that not only chip away at legitimate Israeli positions and claims and entitlements, but really at the core of Jewish history and Jewish identity, most notoriously by now, this series of resolutions that either call into question with quotation marks or parentheses or omit entirely the Jewish connection to our foremost holy sites, namely the Temple Mount, as well as the Western Wall in Jerusalem, as well as other holy sites, by simply featuring Arab and Islamic names for these places that were, of course, originally Jewish in nature and are at the very center of Jewish collective consciousness across time. As to the new director general, we know that ultimately decisions are taken by member states. And that said, we look to any leader within the UN system, including the director general of this agency, of UNESCO, to exert their moral leadership whenever and however possible to ensure that for the sake of the body itself, of its credibility, of its lasting relevance, that the members stay true to the founding purposes and mandate of the organization. And what we've seen in the case of UNESCO is a dramatic straying away from that mandate.
Well, our main message in our meetings in Paris and in Geneva, and we're going to talk about Geneva in just a moment, was this question of the politicization of this UN agency and other UN agencies, that in effect it contaminates, it drags down the original mission of these organizations to a level of simply Israel bashing, and how important it is for the sake of the organization, of course, without saying, for Israel as well, more so, that politicization needs to end. Now, let's move on to Geneva, another agency, the Human Rights Council, which has also become very politicized. It has wrapped up its latest session. Tell us about the results. And also, as we mentioned earlier, you delivered an intervention at the council last week. Tell us about your message at that session. I might add here that the Human Rights Council really is one of the very few multilateral organizations in the world where NGOs like B'nai B'rith can actually take to the floor and deliver an intervention. So tell us about Geneva, what happened there, and what's the future for that agency in terms of our agenda?
Sure. Well, unfortunately, the results at the conclusion of the session of the latest session of the Human Rights Council were fairly predictable. We've seen more resolutions focused on condemning Israel than on any other country in the world, including Iran, including Syria, including North Korea. And each of these resolutions passed. There were five resolutions. There were a number of reports from the Office of the Secretary General, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. All of these were mandated, and their focus was mandated in advance. The resolutions on Israel varied from focus on what it termed as ensuring accountability by calling on member states to reevaluate their sale of military equipment to Israel. Again, Israel alone in the world, and Israel not only the only democracy in the Middle East and the world's only Jewish state, but most likely the only country on the planet today, the only country on Earth to face unending and open calls for its complete destruction. So we have a resolution at the Human Rights Council in the name of protecting Arab or specifically Palestinian human rights, denying the most fundamental human right of all for the Israelis, namely the right to protect their very existence. So a resolution on arms, a resolution on Palestinian self-determination, a resolution on human rights in the Palestinian territories, one on settlements that has advanced, again, in a singular and utterly unjust way, a blacklist targeting companies engaged in disputed territories, but companies engaged with only one side of one conflict, namely companies both Israeli and multinational that do various forms of business on the Israeli side. And finally, perhaps most absurdly, a resolution on what's termed in the UN context the occupied Syrian Golan. So here we have a bloodletting, really an incomparable bloodletting for roughly 7 years now in Syria, a war that's taken more Arab life in only 7 years than the number of Arab lives that have been taken over the course of more than 70 years of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and the Human Rights Council sees fit to pass a resolution focusing and criticizing Israel's continued control of the strategically vital Golan Heights, an area that I'd add is characterized by peace and by coexistence, by diversity. You've got the Druze communities there. this was the last of the five resolutions at the council. Now, unfortunately, there were only two countries, the U.S. and Australia, that voted against each of these resolutions. Others had more mixed records, but we think it's so important to visit Geneva year after year because it's vital that we in the Jewish community and all friends of decency and friends of Israel do our due diligence in making it known among these member states that we're paying close attention, that we value every step in the right direction. There are countries that voted against Israel consistently that will now abstain at the very least on some resolutions. There were countries that only voted with Israel and with the United States in the past on one resolution and may now vote together with fellow democracies like Israel and the United States on two or three resolutions. Each step in the right direction is vitally important, and it's vitally important that these countries know that we're paying attention and that we're going to hold them to account.
Well, I think that
for their record.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, you know, we think of the cliche, but it happens to be true, of speaking truth to power. And this is an opportunity for us to bring our message directly to the ambassadors who represent many countries. You mentioned all of the meetings that we had to talk about the hypocrisy here, to talk about the politicization, to talk about the bias against Israel. And look, this is the truth of the matter is when we talk about the UN becoming irrelevant, the bias against Israel is the strongest piece of evidence of that irrelevance. Now, the Human Rights Council, the reconstituted Human Rights Council, used to be called the Commission, was reformed in 2006. It has, I think, 47 members. And the idea was that it would become less politicized as it reformed and took on a new look. But nothing really has changed. In terms of reform, and we talked a little about this with our interlocutors on this trip, David, what do you think the prospects are for serious reform, either at UNESCO or at the Human Rights Council, given the fact that the issue of irrelevance looms over much of what happens?
Well, you know, you had asked about my intervention at the council a few days ago, and I made this very point, making it known that notwithstanding a casual outside observer's likely assumption that Human Rights Council decisions, or UNESCO decisions for that matter, are unbiased, authoritative, accurate, we know that these are ultimately political bodies in which perceived self-interest, if nothing else, very strongly guides voting, and in which those with less than admirable records on preserving culture, on upholding human rights, sit in judgment of a rare and frankly noble and beleaguered democracy like Israel that for anyone who knows Israel well is utterly synonymous with the values that these bodies were created to champion. As to prospects for reform moving forward, I think reform may be a bit ambitious, particularly in light of the difficult history that we've had at the Human Rights Council since 2006 and the replacement of the commission. I would aim, though, for improvement. If not all-out reform, and certainly not all-out reform overnight, we should be seeing, and we have to see, steps in the right direction. I think there are some signs of hope. You know, most of the European Union member states, along with other major Western democracies, almost all of them, and shame on the exceptions who've broken from this trend, have chosen to refuse to actively participate in the Item 7 deliberations at the Human Rights Council. Item 7, of course, is the dedicated permanent agenda item focused on Israel alone and condemning Israel alone, when the council has a separate agenda item focused on scrutinizing, at least in theory, all other 192 UN member states in the world. So that, I think, is a step in the right direction. We know that the U.S., most notably with the vocal role played by Ambassador Nikki Haley here in New York, has made very clear that everybody that fails to move away from this destructive politicization, this destructive bias, will have to encounter U.S. reevaluation of its role in and support of that body. We've seen that play out at UNESCO, where both the U.S. and Israel have taken steps to disengage. Ambassador Haley has said that the U.S. will be considering similar steps in Geneva. And frankly, allies like the U.K. In its statement last week had said that if things continue as they do now at the Human Rights Council, that country too will begin to more uniformly vote against these hostile and prejudiced resolutions. So I think U.S. influence is key. We have a still relatively new Secretary General of the UN who has openly spoken against double standards within the system. I think between these factors and others, there still is at least modest potential for progress in moving away from the bias over the course of the next few years.
Well, there's no question that leadership, either from the United States, from Great Britain, or someone like Secretary General Guterres, who with whom we met not long after he came into his position, and he recognizes, I believe, the politicization issue. We still have this numbers game issue as well with the block voting, which is a challenge that will have to be overcome, and there, I'm sure, are creative ways of addressing that. But the will has to be there at the top, but it also has to be there with NGOs like B'nai B'rith, which has been associated with the organization for as long as it has, serving as a monitor, as you pointed out, and serving as an organization that engages those who are involved in policymaking at the UN to move it back on the right track and to move it away from this obsession, this bias against Israel, which, again, has moved the organization closer and closer to irrelevance. David, thank you for joining us today, for having this discussion. There'll be no shortage of other issues regarding the UN, I'm sure, going forward, and we'll have an opportunity to discuss them as they come up. But we certainly appreciate this quick recap of B'nai B'rith's recent visit with its delegation to Paris and to Geneva. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
And thank you, everyone, for listening to our podcast. Please visit our website, B'nai B'rith.org, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, subscribe on your smartphone through the podcast app for iPhone or through Google Play for Android. And lastly, tell a friend about us. For my guest, David Michaels, I'm Dan Mariascia. We'll talk to you next time on the B'nai B'rith International Podcast.